Into the Weird, episode 30, Night of the Living Dummy.
Welcome to Into the Weird, a podcast celebrating the madness and magnificence of the mighty Marvel Bronze Age. I'm your host, Billy D, and alongside me is my co-host, the Hound of Hell himself, Herman Lowe. How are you, buddy?
I'm great, Billy, thanks. Hey, if I'm the Hound of Hell, that implies I've got a master. In fact, it could imply that Dracula's my master, if you've seen the Satanic Rites of Dracula.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm fine with that. I'd serve the Dark Lord any day of the week, especially on a Sunday.
And then and we also know that, you know, when Silver Dagger dies, he's going to go to the bad place. So you can torture him while you're down there.
Well, that's what our listeners are going to find out if they don't know about that already. So way to spoil it, Billy. No, that's not spoiling anything. It's so much more than that, listeners. Just be patient and we'll get to that. But, yeah. Like you mentioned, Billy, this is the end of the Silver Dagger storyline that you and I are going to be dealing with today. But it's also another ending, which makes me, even though I'm the Hound of Hell, it also makes me, depressed, Herman, this week. Mm-hmm. Because what's happening, you know, once we've done discussing this comic?
Yeah, I mean, this is the end of Engelhart and Brunner. So, you know, it's kind of sucks, but there's some good things afterwards as well. But we're going to talk about, you know, this issue and then, you know, some of our highlights with this team, because, you know, I think we both agree that they are our favorite combination for Doctor Strange. I think he had no better friends than the Engelhart and Brunner team.
I think so, too. And they added so much to his mythology, right, Billy? Think about that. They upgraded Doctor Strange to his Sorcerer Supreme status. But they also made it seem as if it's not just something that happened in Tibet when he spent a couple of years there with the Ancient One and then emerged as the Sorcerer Supreme. No, he had to work for it. And it's not just study and practice. This is actually going through these horrific trials. First facing all the denizens of Cthulhu in the Marvel Universe, basically. Shuma-Gorath, you know, he had to beat them one by one until he encountered this ultimate threat, which led to him having to make the decision to kill the Ancient One, his mentor, in order to assume his mantle and his power. And even then, that was not the end. Even then, he still had to go through through a magical gauntlet. He had to literally die, which is what happened in the last two issues we discussed, issues 3 and 4, specifically 4. And then, you know, he assumed the mantle of eternity briefly in order to realize how to accept and to harness this power over death itself. He had to become one with eternity briefly. And we'll see how that has affected him in this issue when he comes face to face with one of his, I think, arguably greatest foes, Silver Dagger. He's definitely in my top three Doctor Strange foes, you know, or maybe I should say top four. For me, it's going to be my favorite being Shuma-Gorath, but the ultimate Doctor Strange villain being Dormammu, right, Billy? Then I would say Shuma-Gorath, and then possibly Nightmare and Baron Mordo. But I'd replace Baron Mordo with Silver Dagger there, even though that would seem like blasphemy. In, you know, if you take the whole of Doctor Strange as a whole into account, I would still do that because Baron Mordo never took Doctor Strange to the brink like this. Mm-mm. You know, he's this Silver Dagger really gave Doctor Strange a run for his magical, you know, currency. So I don't know, man.
Killed him.
Yeah, literally, he killed him. Yeah, he did. Now, as we know in comics, that's never the end, but here it's very well explained by Brunner and Engelhart here. I mean, we know that Brunner was co-plotting at this time. A lot of the stories before this, he even, you know, generated, of course, with Engelhardt in tow, but Brunner was firmly also in the driving seat where the plot was concerned, along with Engelhardt. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they conceived of this death as a means of showing that how was the Ancient One actually able to live through all those centuries. In the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it was explained that he had sort of made a deal with Dormammu and then turned on Dormammu, you know, for this the price of immortality. But here it's more, I think, fleshed out, right, Billy? It's more intricate. It's you literally have to become the Sorcerer Supreme and to become the Ancient One, which Doctor Strange now is, he had to overcome death. And yeah, because it's the Marvel Universe, that happened with a magical battle between Doctor Strange and the personification of death. So pretty amazing. So Billy, without further ado, we're going to start. We're only doing this one issue this time around, listeners. And this is specifically Doctor Strange Volume 2, Issue Number 5. And I'm going to give you the more information on this issue. It was published in December of 1974. Cover art by Frank Brunner, Jim Starlin, and Gaspar Saladino. And I've got a little bit of something to mention about Gaspar Saladino later on, Billy. The editor-in-chief here was Len Wein. And the story is entitled Cloak and Dagger, with the writers Steve Englehart and Frank Brunner, penciler Frank Brunner, inker Dick Giordano, colorist Bill Mantlo. Mm-hmm. Billy, what the hell? I mean, not only was Bill Mantlo having to fill in for, you know, absent writers, he was a pinch hitter when it came to writing, he was also a colorist every now and then.
Yeah, I think I remember reading that he kind of, that's how he started actually doing work, was, you know, a spot job on colors or even letters, I think, if I'm not mistaken. He was a one-man army with being able to...
Yeah, one-man band when it came with dealing with helping out, we should say, in the bullpen. Mm-hmm. Well done, Bill. And lettered by Tom Orakowski and editor Roy Thomas. The editor-in-chief, of course, Len Wein at the time. Roy Thomas specifically edited this title. And also one of my favorite Doctor Strange issues from the early days, Billy. I'd say at least in my, you know, top 10. It's not, my favorite, which we've discussed in previous issues. But this one definitely up there. It's a great, great issue featuring Silver Dagger's origin and the final battle between Doctor Strange and Silver Dagger. And it also has some great clear action, fantastic art from Brenner. Mm-hmm. And, it sort of wraps up this part of Doctor Strange's life, where now the next part mm-hmm. will be chronicled by, of course, the Master himself, Gene Colan, and Steve Englehart. But that does firmly feel like an ending, right, Billy, to something that Brunner and Englehart started. So pretty seminal issue, yeah. I'd say.
Yeah, you're not wrong there for sure. Absolutely. And I can just tell you that for all the listeners out there, when we looked at, you know, who's doing what synopsis and we kind of like rotate back and forth, I was overjoyed to see that you were going to be the one to have to encapsulate this issue, because
the origin of Silver Dagger having this weird religious angle. Yeah, Billy, I know. Me, a heathen. I did write up a pretty scathing synopsis of this guy.
Imagine.
So I've got that ready for us. But before I get to that, Billy, though, I want to ask you specifically, since this is the end of the Brunner and Englehart run, what is your recollection of this comic when you first read it? Like, was it, you know, when you acquired the Doctor Strange Masterworks in the early 2000s, the Essentials, or was it way back when you were young, when you picked up this issue?
I think the first time I read this is, and it took me a little while to recall this, but I think I had, like right now, I was reading these first few issues in that little, like, I don't want to say it's a trade, but, you know, there's like four 1, 2, 4, and 5, or 1, 2, 3, and 5, whatever it is, they're all in one thing, you know, one book with that crazy Wrightson cover.
The one you recommended to me. Do you remember three shows back? Yeah. Or I should say three Doctor Strange episodes back. You recommended that one to me. That was an amazing collection. Came out in the early 1980s, and it chronicled the Silver Dagger storyline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where I read this first. So, you know, I read the story complete. Which was awesome, and I still have that issue to this day, and I love it, and I think it's one of the best, like, stories, you know, over, like, a few issues like that that I've ever read. Love it, and that's when I first read it, and I was, you know, a teenager, so I wasn't as shocked by some of it.
Yeah.
But now that I think about it in the context of 1974, it is pretty wild because, you know, like we're going to go into detail about here when you read your synopsis and we talk about it, it's got some some pretty edgy stuff for 1974.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as a kid when I read this, because I've also got a bit of a history with this comic in particular, it's true that, you know, the Catholic Church, you know, in various points in history, they gave birth to these fanatics who, you know, these fundamentalists who literally interpreted the Bible and witch burnings and all of that. We'll get into that as we go through Silver Dagger's origin. But, you know, when I was a kid, this was one of the issues, or the Doctor Strange issues, that was in the Long Box of Darkness, that black, you know, old box. Actually, it wasn't a typical long box. I think I mentioned this before. It was a long box for records. You know what I mean, Billy? Like, and it was black, and my uncle had used that to collect his comics in. You know, he was a big record collector as well, of LPs and stuff. So this was probably an extra one he had lying around, and then he used it to stuff his comics in, and he gave it to me. Gotcha. So, you know, but there was quite a lot in there. And then it was also like, I don't know if he custom made it even, you know, because it didn't look like a normal one that you could find, you know, in the record stores, you know, of the time. But whatever, there was a lot of Doctor Strange issues in there. He was a Doctor Strange fan. I think I could say that of him. He was more of a horror fan, of course. Horror and westerns and sword and sorcery, all of that was in the long box. Not so much a superhero fan, but there were some superhero comics in there, specifically, at least, I would say, this is now just guessing, I can't remember exactly how many, but at least 10 Doctor Strange issues. You know, most of them from the 1970s, mid-1970s, early 1970s. So this was one of those issues that was in there, right, Billy? But the first time I read it as a kid, rifling through that long box, I don't know the first time actually I read it, but I remember rereading it and then not thinking much of it because it was out of, you know, order. I read it out of order. I didn't read the previous issues, which he didn't have in, you know, available, my uncle. So I was a little bit confused, to say the least. All I knew is that there was this guy who had kidnapped Doctor Strange's girlfriend, and he kept her in a sewer, and Doctor Strange somehow managed to enter into the sewer as some form of vapor, and then, you know, managed to free his girlfriend. And then, you know, banished this guy. That's basically, but that's not what happened at all, listeners. That's just in my childlike mind, I remember something like that. So the art was great, but I didn't appreciate this issue for what it was. You know what I mean, Billy? But you kind of have to read the entire storyline to fully realize the greatness that's being put on the comic book page here. So I'm going to head into that now with my synopsis, and I hope I do this issue justice, because it features one of the more wacky villain origins out there, right, Billy?
Yeah, for sure. This one's crazy, and like I said, for 1974, man, we thought they were trying to push the envelope with that CC Neg story, but I'd say this one goes a bit further.
Yeah, this one directly criticizes one of the established religions, you know, so we'll get into that right now. All right, and remember, folks, you have to remember this comic book was published after William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist novel and then the movie by William Friedkin. So, you know, people were, you know, they were on a lot of people were on a religious crusade. You know, they believed exorcisms were real. In fact, exorcisms had spiked all over the country and, in fact, the world after the release of The Exorcist. You know, and Billy, what does that prove? It proves that, you know, once something becomes a fad, then suddenly, you know, people think it's real and they start to believe in exorcism. And then suddenly, you know, it starts to spike. It's not because there is an actual need for exorcism. You know, it's because crazy births more crazy. And that's just my mind, in my mind. But, you know, all right, so let's get into the synopsis here, right, for issue number 5 of Doctor Strange, Volume 2. Mm-hmm. Our story opens with Silver Dagger relentlessly torturing Clea in a continued attempt to brainwash her and indoctrinate her in the ways of the Lord, which we learn later is, in fact, the devil-hunting doctrine of the Catholic Church. Since conventional means of torture fail, he decides to whip out his most sinister weapon, his origin story. As it turns out, Silver Dagger, whose real name is Isaiah Kerwin, by the way, not mentioned in the comic, was a devout priest and later cardinal of the Vatican, sporting robes and all, and he eventually became a possible successor to the Pope. However, he was rejected due to his youth and specifically his fanaticism. This disappointment led him on a different path. The path to the Vatican's library. There, he found ancient tomes of dark magic, which he studied in the name of the Lord, absorbing the black arts so that he could fight fire with fire. And in his madness, he believed that God spoke to him and commanded him to slay all the magic users of the world, since they were unholy and had to be cleansed. He traveled extensively after this, seeking out masters of the mystic arts, training his mind, body, and his magicka to a level almost rivaling that of the Ancient One himself. Naturally, after learning all there was to learn from each teacher, he slew him or her with his enchanted silver dagger, the traditional weapon used against demons and the unholy. His final victim was to be the Ancient One himself, but Silver Dagger discovered to his dismay that the old sorcerer was gone and that someone else had taken his place. Stephen Strange, the new Sorcerer Supreme. Clea, meanwhile, had passed out, possibly because of the mental strain of absorbing such a freakishly outlandish origin. Silver Dagger then proceeds to waterboard her. Sorta. Doctor Strange, recently victorious in his battle against death, then emerges into the realm of the living through the Eye of Agamotto, which had been taken by Silver Dagger, of course. The Doc's spirit is discombobulated after sharing the perceptions of eternity, and he mistakenly inhabits the headless Doctor Strange wax dummy that Silver Dagger had been using to torture Clea. The possessed effigy attacks Silver Dagger, who easily defeats it, but this allows Clea enough time to absorb Steven's spirit, allowing him to piggyback on her mind. She uses her lover's added power to bolster her own, escaping the lair of Silver Dagger, which turned out to be a sewer. And she flees towards the Sanctum Sanctorum, which is only a few blocks away. Silver Dagger is in hot pursuit and brandishes the Eye of Agamotto, which he uses to break through the defenses of the Sanctum. He then comes face to face with Clea and a revived Doctor Strange, who has by now re-inhabited his true mortal form. And a mystic battle of epic awesomeness commences. Seizing control of the Eye of Agamotto and mentally wresting it from his foe's grasp, Stephen turns its light back upon Silver Dagger, forcing him to see the truth and the lies behind his twisted quest and religion. Silver Dagger then repents and leaps into the now giant Eye of Agamotto. He is instantly banished to the realm of unreality, where a lone caterpillar is all too happy to offer him a pull of his mushroom hookah. The end. Now, rather than, you know, not spoil anything, I decided to leap, you know, into the fire and just spoil everything of this entire issue. But Billy, there's a lot to unpack here, so
yeah.
We're going to be discussing this one for at least another 30 minutes, listeners. So, Billy, a great issue once again, as we've come to expect from Brunner and Engelhardt. What did you think of this particular tale?
We'll be back after a quick break.
It's time to take a ride down the audiobook trail.
I am John McClane. Welcome to the podcast. I ended up discovering the world of audiobooks and thinking, you know what? I've found my spot. We'll do bloopers because I have thousands of them. I love a good story. And, you know, I have to admit, as far as vocations go, this one's pretty cool.
This is the Audiobook Trail Podcast.
We're going to drop a 30-minute episode every 2 weeks. Audiobooktrail.com.
I love it. And like I said, I didn't, when I first read this issue, it didn't really, I was like, okay, this is pretty cool. But then, you know, years later, you go back and read it again. You're like, wow, this guy was really crazy. And they were pretty bold for doing this though. But I mean, it's not that far from, you know, there are people that get, you know, take something and get crazy, get fanatical about it. And that's exactly what this guy did. But it's just hilarious that it's one of these things where I'm thinking, he basically, when he got turned down to become the Pope, he just completely snapped when he saw the other guy get the crown. He said, what does he say? So later I watched as another received my papal crown.
My papal crown. That's what he said. My papal crown. You're right.
And then he snaps because he sees that. I'm like, what a crybaby. So then he's creeping through the Vatican and it says, it was then I came to comprehend the power of the devil.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm thinking, yeah, he snapped and he goes into the library, like you said. But here we go with these like biblical references. So he goes into the library for 6 days and six nights. I stayed in that library. And on the seventh day, I succeeded. He's shooting like a mystic bolt. And then he's got books piled up there. And one of them is the
Necronomicon.
So the Vatican has a copy of the Necronomicon. I'm like, oh, okay.
Oh, man. Come on. The Necronomicon doesn't even have anything to do with Satan. Come on. Cthulhu wipes his butt with Christian doctrine. Come on. With demonology. This has got nothing. Anyway. Well, Billy, man, I love the fact that they made him out. Well, it's his ego, really, right, that led him down this path, because he couldn't stand being rejected, you know, by the Council of Cardinals. And the Pope was even in his corner. The Pope said he supports his ascension, you know, Silver Dagger's ascension to the Pope. Let's call him Isaiah, right? Isaiah Kerwin. You know, but I love the fact that he starts his origin by saying, my story begins with the Vatican. And then, you know, his deep reverence, you know, and then suddenly being rejected means that he understood the ways of the devil. This is always ego speaking. You know, he was not elected. Mm-hmm. It means the devil held sway even in the church. And so he tried to comprehend the turn of events and the Lord's will by poring over tomes in the library, you know, doing some reading. That's how he decided to deal with his disappointment here. And then he found all these tomes, you know, that it's true. The Vatican has hoarded all these books. You know, we don't know exactly which books, but, you know, in real life, right, Billy, the Vatican has this massive collection of all kinds of religious tomes, you know, and presumably some written that, you know, they don't agree with, but they keep it, you know, as reference to study the black arts. Well, not the black arts, mystically speaking, but, you know, obviously, you know, they want to familiarize themselves with the enemy. Now, here we have Silver Dagger then realizing he's got a knack for black magic, but still he you know, remains religious. You know, he remains fanatical. He's a servant of the Lord. He's turning the weapons of the enemy against themselves. So he travels to all of these places, Tibet, Egypt. He travels to India. He learns from fakirs, you know, from necromancers, from martial arts masters, and he kills all of them right after he's absorbed all the knowledge he can from them. And he basically builds his body into this kind of a living weapon. And along the way, he acquires this enchanted silver dagger, right, Billy? So which is mm-hmm. his go-to weapon for executing these enemies of Christ. Now, Billy, then listen, this is interesting, right? When he starts to speak about, you know, how people, you know, he mentions how the world should revere these ancient figures who were like himself. He speaks about the inquisitors from the Spanish Inquisition and how they were heroes. He also talks about Cotton Mather. You know, Cotton Mather was a real-life historical figure who was associated with the Salem witch trials in the 17th century. And, you know, he was one of the witch hunters, or at least the people involved with the witch hunters who burned the witches at the stake and, you know, tested women for witchcraft. And we know all of that is BS. There was never any witchcraft. It was simple things like, you know, being a midwife and then, you know, being present at the birth of a child with a deformity that could get you, you know, burned at the stake. You know, if you want to, you know, have a bit more reference, check out that brilliant Vincent Price movie, Witchfinder General, right, Billy, from the...
Or Twins of Evil. Watch that.
Twins of Evil. Yeah, that's another great
one. Those guys are maniacs. They run around killing people just because... kill a woman just because she's not married.
Yeah, yeah. And it really did happen. You know, all of these flimsy excuses for killing someone. And then you had the women who were more devout in the church, who maybe had rivals, or, you know, they, you know, other women were their enemies or rivals for their husband's affections, who knew? And then they would lie to the witch finder general just to get that woman burned at the stake, you know, for just looking at her husband or something. You know, it was all of these flimsy excuses. And of course the witch finders would do that. You know, Cotton Mather was more than happy to burn anyone at the stake because they got paid for it. You know, they literally got paid for finding these witches.
So well, this is I love the part that Engelhart writes, and this is, now listen to me. Anybody that's out there, just listen to this, that if you believe in any kind of, you know, higher power, this is what Silverdagger says to himself. God had a more important task in mind for me. I was to become his personal weapon in his long dormant war upon Satan. Okay, so listen. If you believe in a higher power or a deity, they are not going to tell you, you are my personal weapon to go out and kill people. They're not going to do it. So just take my word for it. That's not real. If you're hearing those voices in your head, go see a shrink, because it's not going to happen. All
right? Well, that's true, stop, man. I mean, isn't it true that they say that, you know, when you're hearing voices in your head telling you to kill people, you're crazy. But when you're a biblical figure hearing voices in your head telling you to kill people, like, you know, Abraham had to kill his son, hey, you're a holy man, you know, so you're just religious. So, you know, yeah, this is their view of that. And we already know that they, you know, tried to criticize the creation story by providing an alternate account in the Marvel Universe of CZ Neg, you know, the CZ Neg saga. Mm-hmm. Now, that was just for entertainment's sake. That was not, but it was clearly to show that, you know, not everything is as it seems. You know, you can not always take these ancient mythological stories as facts, right, Billy? And in fact, that is true. You know, I mean, the religions of today in 1,000 years might be the mythology of tomorrow. And in fact, that is what happened with the religions of Egypt and Greece and, you know, even the Roman religions before Constantine the Emperor, you know, adopted Christianity in the 6th century. So, you know, all of these things, we kind of need to learn that, you know, there are these ways of trying to explain reality. Right, Billy? Mm-hmm. And this is Silver Dagger trying to explain his own reality. But what he's not using science. He's not using facts. He's not using rational observation. He's using speculation and delusion, you know, or what he wants to be true. I mean, think about it. He probably did hear a voice in his head, but this was his own mind, because we know he's insane. He's completely insane.
He's nuts.
I mean, even the cardinal, the Council of Cardinals recognized that. That's why his fanaticism is another word for his insanity. And they turned him down because of that. They realized you can't have this irrational individual in the seat of power. So because of his insanity, he comes up with another reason for his rejection. And he like you said, he states that as being God wants him to be a personal weapon against the forces of evil.
My gosh.
So, you know, all of this is ridiculous. But, you know, in the Marvel Universe, Billy, we kind of have to take this at face value, because we know there is a Satan in the Marvel Universe. There is a Mephisto. And of course, there is an entity that could be called a type. Well, we know the entity in the Marvel Universe whose god is CZ Neg, right?
Well, I mean, if you look at it, like we've said this before, like Marvel for a little while kind of dabbled with things. And then I don't know if it was Shooter or who it was that came along and said, we're not doing that.
Yeah.
So you can have these like.
They capitulated. Types.
Yeah, but there is no God and there is no devil. Like, you know, that's not, we don't want to do that. They just kind of wanted to stay away from that. But for a while there was talk about that in the comics, definitely in the Bronze Age.
Yeah.
But eventually, I don't know, it was the early age, they were like, yeah, we're not doing that.
So that's right.
Well, but they did go down that road.
You kind of have to remember why this was happening and why people like Engelhardt and Brunner were challenging these accepted notions of the church. Because in the early 1970s, and that's why it relates to movies like The Exorcist, this whole idea that God was dead, coming from also Nietzschean philosophy from way back, 100 years earlier. But, in the 1970s, this sort of culminated in the pop culture of the time. You know, you had films like Rosemary's Baby, then you had, of course, The Exorcist, novels first and then films. And then, the Omen later on. All of these films was as a direct result of the zeitgeist of the time changing and looking at religion in a different way, and the world in a different way. You had the Vietnam War and you had all these atrocities before the Vietnam War that happened. And people were trying to justify that in their minds. Like, how could any God who is objectively good allow these things to happen? They were trying to square that in their minds. Like, why is creation the way it is? Is it our fault because of original sin? Or is it actually the person who created the conditions for original sin to occur in? Because after all, Billy, if you know everything that's going to happen, then you're to blame. Because do you know what I mean? Like, if you're omnipresent, omniscient and omnibenevolent, but you allow evil to exist, then, and even the fact that there is a devil, in Silver Dagger's case, that's just a scapegoat for saying, I don't want to accept responsibility for my own actions. The devil did it. It's him. He seduced me, or he, led me astray. It's just a way for humans to say, okay, I want a scapegoat. It's not me. They don't want to accept responsibility for their own actions. So they blame the devil. You know what I mean? So,
well, you know what? You're saying about movies, I think even earlier than the early 70s, because when did that Hammer film come out?
In 1969, I think, or 68. It was based off of Edgar Allan Poe's The Conqueror War. Oh, you're not talking about Witch Hunter Devil. Are you talking a Witch Hunter General? You're talking, because that's not Hammer. You're talking about The Devil Rides Out?
Yeah, that one. Where there was the goat guy and everything. Holy crap, that was wild, man. That was like, yep, there's the devil and everything like that. So they were already even starting to push it in the late 60s, and you figure that's probably when, guys like Engelhardt and Brunner, they were probably tuned into that, because that was a book too before it came out. I can't remember the guy's name that wrote it, but they were probably reading that stuff and going to see was it Dennis Wheatley?
Yeah, Dennis Wheatley. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, so they were probably reading that kind of stuff and saying, well, that's a cool part of this movie. And like you said, not only are they taking, little bits and pieces of movies and books and things they've read and incorporating it into the comics, but like you said, also thinking like, hey, for decades people were, I think a lot of parents were, instead of saying to their kids, hey, this is what we believe, but, hey, you have freedom of choice, believe what you want to believe, they were being force-fed stuff and saying, this is how things are, and don't question it. And when that generation of people came around, like the Engelhardt and Brunners, they were just more like, hey, why can't we question this? And what about this? And what about that? And that's, like you said, you and I have talked before, that's not, questioning and trying to figure out the validity of something is not bad. That's never a bad thing to do.
Yeah, true. So this was their way of doing that, right, Billy? And I think editorial didn't quite realize that at the time. Or if they did, they allowed it because, lots of people were given free rein in the 70s at Marvel specifically to generate their own stories. I mean, when Stan put the brakes on that CZ Neg storyline, they found a way around it, of course, Brenner and Engelhardt, by writing that letter from the reverend, from the minister, who liked the issue, who never existed. But, you know, I think after that, you know, they allowed it. They allowed, you know, a few religious stories. And like you said, maybe when the, you know, advent of Shooter came around, that's when they put the brakes on that again. But in this case, you know, I think as a kid, I didn't fully understand what they were doing here. You know, Engelhardt and Brunner, they were firmly guys that tried to question, like you say, Billy, everything. And this is their way of doing that. Yeah. They showed that, you know, in any religion, a fanatic can arise who takes the doctrine literally. Now remember, what is written in the Old Testament in the Bible was taken literally by the church for centuries, right, Billy? That's basically why, one of the reasons we had the Dark Ages, you know? It's, you know, people should be killed if they're homosexuals. You know, they should be stoned, or they should be ostracized from society. Demons exist because, after all, or possession, you know, happens because, you know, Jesus, you know, exorcised some demons in the New Testament. So all of these things they literally believed in, and that's what led to the eventual Spanish Inquisition and also the witch trials, specifically the ones in Salem mentioned here. And, you know, it led to the death of thousands, hundreds of thousands of innocent people.
Yeah, and people like Engelhardt and other writers down the road, they're still going, like we said, they're still going to dabble in things too, because there's like exorcisms and stuff like that in comic books, like either Doctor Strange or Damon Hellstrom and stuff like that. So there's still other writers and, you know, artists that still kind of dabble in some of those themes. But I don't think anybody really went down this road, not that I can think of off the top of my head, with, you know, religious concepts. Can you think of any? I can't really. Not in the Bronze Age, or not for Marvel or DC. Like, maybe if you get to an independent company where, you know, they were off the radar, they did some wild stuff. But Marvel and DC, I don't, like, DC really steered away from this stuff.
Yeah, no, they did not deal with this at all. I think they were trying to play it safe sales-wise, right? But, you know, this did not affect Doctor Strange's sales at all. It, in fact, boosted the sales. And like you mentioned, titles like Damon Hellstrom, they did not directly criticize any established religion. They sort of just you know, took the idea of Satanism, or, you know, they took the biblical mythology of Satan and Lucifer and that, and, you know, fallen angels. And then they married it with this idea of the Antichrist and, you know, the son of Satan. And then they created their own thing, you know, so their own mythology, so to speak. So it wasn't really a direct criticism. This is, like you say, a direct criticism of an established religion, right, Billy? This is criticizing Catholicism here, saying that it could lead to fanaticism. And that's what happens at the end, right, Billy? Right after, you know, Clea escapes and leads Silver Dagger pursues her to the Sanctum Sanctorum. And the Eye of Agamotto is turned back upon Silver Dagger. That's when he realizes the fallacy of his beliefs, you know, the fact that he is, in fact, a fanatic, and that someone who has done so much good for the world, Doctor Strange, having saved the Earth uncountable times up to this point already, that he would try to kill someone like this. And, in fact, he has been doing the devil's work himself, if you think about it like that, because he's been taking out all these champions of...
He's killing people.
Yeah, he's killing people. He's murdering people. He's a murderer. He's an assassin for the Lord.
It's not like it's a wartime and he's a soldier and something like that's going on. He's just killing people that he doesn't agree with. So, yeah, the dude's a murderer. Doesn't matter what he tries to say. But, yeah, Doctor Strange has some really good dialogue there at the end, you know, when he's telling him, because he turns the eye on him and he says... Dr. Strange says, "You deceive yourself as you've always deceived yourself, Dagger, and now you shall know it." And Silver Dagger's like, "Turn it away, stop." And Strange says, "The eye is not a gun, answerable only to him who holds it. It is a conduit for any who understands it, and I am the Sorcerer Supreme, a man of knowledge, while you are only a man of learning. You think magic is no more than obscure phrases and arcane gestures, a recipe to be read and applied. Such a belief may take you far, Dagger, but not as far as I have gone. Let your eyes meet the eye and see." And there's a panel you probably go crazy over with that giant eyeball, and it's zapping the crap out of him. And it shows him that how much of a maniac he is. And he's like, "I see. All that you say is truth." And then what does he do?
Yeah, he jumps into the Eye of Agamotto. He leaps into the center of it, which the eye has now become, you know, titanic in size, right? So he's absorbed into the eye and into the realm of Agamotto, which is this realm of unreality that Steven entered when he was at death's door, right, Billy? And now, Silver Dagger, the only way to escape the eye is to, in fact, do what Steven has done, and that is impossible because he does not have the skills needed to escape the realm of death. But at least he's got the caterpillar for company, and the caterpillar wouldn't have it any other way because he knows that this guy's not leaving.
Yeah, why would you want to leave? You can just sit there and eat mushrooms all day and smoke the pipe. Why
even try to get out of there? Exactly. Unlike Steven, who had a reason to leave, he had to save Clea. You know, here Silver Dagger's just chilling with the caterpillar.
Yeah, you had mentioned the part two when he's doing his origin spiel, and then the next page he tries to, you know, talk directly to Clea, and he goes, unconscious, eh? And I was thinking more like she was bored out of her mind listening to this fruitcake, so she just fell asleep. And then he dumps a canister of water on her face to wake her up.
Exactly, man. It looked like he was waterboarding her there, but of course he was just trying to wake her up. But, I mean, she's unconscious, lying there with her mouth open, gaping open, and he's, like, pouring this jug of water into her face. She doesn't wake up. She's, like, still unconscious. But, you know, Billy, there's a couple of great moments here, not just related to Silver Dagger's origin. You know, there's this bit where Steven, you know, exits the Eye of Agamotto, and then he floats through Silver Dagger's abode, and then he, because he's disorientated, he sees this shape sprawled on the ground, and he thinks this to be his own body. And in fact, this is the wax dummy. You remember a couple of issues earlier that Silver Dagger had beheaded in order to mentally torture Clea. Now, this wax dummy is lying right next to a litter, like a trash can, which says, don't litter, right? Mm-hmm. It's in the sewer. Steven then thinks it to be his own body, and he enters it and then briefly reanimates this headless wax dummy to... He even, on his stumbling way, he kicks his own head, the wax dummy's head across the floor. Oh, man, that's macabre. And then he enters, you know, the room where Clea's being tortured, and then Silver Dagger sees the wax dummy and he's shocked. He says, good lord, the dummy is walking, and he thinks it's Clea's doing, and he starts to slice this wax dummy apart, right, Billy? And then Clea realizes that since this is not her magic, it must be Steven, so she touches the dummy, the torso of the dummy, but not before Silver Dagger, after battling the dummy, he says, you know, don't attempt such things again, witch. Now, excuse me, nature calls. So he's going to take a dump or something. Holy God. And then that allows Clea, while he's on the toilet, it allows Clea to touch the dummy and absorb Dr. Strange's spirit. Oh my God, what do you think of that, Billy?
Does he even have a toilet? They're in the sewer. Maybe he just goes and squats over by like the
runoff. He just squats over there in the sewer drain, or the sewer funnel.
This was a dark comic. Like, the subject matter is pretty dark and everything about it's pretty dark, but it did have a couple of moments of humor, and that was one of them, the dummy walking and then kicking the head and
like a soccer ball, man.
He has to go relieve himself
in take a dump and then wherever. But this next page makes up for all this grossness, right, Billy? Basically, when Steven's spirit fuses with that of Clea, this is a fantastic page, a fantastic panel of Clea absorbing Dr. Strange's spirit. And it seems that not only is she, you know, electrified with these little, you know, this lightning effect, she's also, there's like a background image of Dr. Strange's brain, you know, fusing with Clea's, and then
his astral form.
And then he's sort of like whispering in her ear, you know, like as a ghost. But then, you know, this reunion is almost the equivalent of, you know, that Swamp Thing issue where Abby and Swamp Thing merge consciousness after, you know, it's kind of like astral sex, right?
Yeah.
After Abby eats a tuber off of Swamp Thing's body. This is like that because Clea's got this. She's encountering this like ethereal sense of wonder as this happens, as she fuses with Steven's spirit. She's one with the universe briefly there, right? And then Silver Dagger appears after, you know, wiping his butt, and then he says, You know, he sees her, Clea, you know, reinvigorated, and Clea then uses Doctor Strange's power to blast his manacles to smithereens, and you know, Silver Dagger's like, "Mother of mercy! This is a miracle! I mean, she was near the breaking point!" He almost says miracle, and then he checks himself, because he doesn't want to use the word miracle associated with this witch. And Clea levitates out of there, through the sewer drain, and then runs down.
Yeah, how she pulls that off.
Yeah, man, she's got like a brief, a magical surge of power that allows her to become ethereal, right? Kitty Pryde style. Mm-hmm. And she's intangible. She exits the sewer grate, and she's still in Greenwich Village. She runs down, you know, the streets of the village towards, you know, the Sanctum Sanctorum. And we see her pass a marquee that has 2001, A Space Odyssey, right, playing. Did you see that, Billy? And a guy, beatnik or something, dressed in these puffy sleeves that Steven so loves, you know, gaping after her. And then, you know, Silver Dagger, he realizes he's got to pursue her, but he takes the Eye of Agamotto with him, so he's going to need it, right, Billy? And then, you know, as Clea enters the Sanctum Sanctorum, and she confronts Wong, who's surprised, you know, to say the least, Silver Dagger's heading down the streets himself, and he's accosted by this, what turns out to be a beggar, but then immediately becomes a mugger, and, oh, this is terrible. This is a black guy, an African-American guy. Shame on you guys, Frank Brenner and Engelhardt. And this mugger tries to, well, he wants to, you know, beat up Silver Dagger for, you know, ignoring him first, but he's definitely going to take his money off of him. And what does Silver Dagger do?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wish you could sip cocktails and discuss great books with your friends while hanging out in a rundown piano bar? Here on the Literary Guys podcast, that's what we do. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan. Each month, we discuss books from two different views of modern masculinity.
From both a gay
and a straight perspective.
From To Kill a Mockingbird
to future governors in the jungle trying to kill a predator. We welcome everyone to join our conversation on the good and toxic of what literature and pop culture have to say about masculinity. So pour yourself a drink and join us now for Season 3.
Literary Guys. That's G-U-I-S-E. LiteraryGuys.com.
I see what you did there.
Well, it's funny. The guy. This is the guy's dialogue. "Say, man, that white-on-white chick blew right past me. But you look like a cat who'd stop to lay some spare change on me." And Silver Dagger says, "Unhand me. I have business with that chick."
Chick.
And the guy says, "First you got some business with me, my man. Then with a doctor, or maybe the coroner." And Silver Dagger whips out the Eye of Agamotto and says, "Oh no, filth. You're the one who'll keep that appointment." And it looks like he blasts the guy's head completely off.
Dude, he blasts his flesh from his bones completely, because they say in the caption box, "The skulker's a skeleton ere he touches the ground." Damn.
Yeah, so that's awful.
He completely eviscerates this guy and flays the flesh from his bones. And then the very next panel is a horrific scene of Stephen Inclia's body seeing his own corpse, basically, and then Steven's even got this mental thought bubble saying, "Gods, my own corpse."
And he goes, and then Clea, "Wong, why is it here?" And Wong, "I could not bring myself to begin the journey to the crypts of Kau, miss. The master's death was so odd, and the body had not deteriorated." And then she does a little, you know, she goes over there near the body, and Steven kind of, she kind of like gestures, and his astral form goes into the body, and then it's on from there.
A bit of sexual innuendo there too, Billy, like Clea saying, "He's sliding free of me." She's got this look of ecstasy. And then as Steven slides free of her, he returns to his form with this weird effect. It's like a mist, right, Billy, exiting Clea's forehead and then entering Steven's body. And and then Steven has this great bit of, you don't know if Wong and Clea are privy to his thoughts, but his thought bubble saying that, I see now that rather than returning to reality fully reborn, I've been passing through stages leading to that end, from one with all to a single spirit searching for humanity to stabilization within you. That's what he's referring. He's referring to Clea here, and then he says, "To a living man," and then Clea's like, "Steven!" The tears are,
and she's weeping,
spilling out of her eyes, and then Wong's got this look of rapture on his face, right? Like, you know, one of Jesus's disciples, and then downstairs, you know, Agamotto in the hands of silver daggers used to breach the sanctorum. And then, you know, Steven dismisses Wong. He realizes there's going to be a magical battle. He says, "Wong, you have no magic. You need to leave. Clea, you remain." And she says, "As if I would leave you now, Steven." Here at the end.
Oh, man. But Silver Dagger, his dialogue, as he's coming into the house. "Beware, heretics. Silver Dagger will not be denied."
Heretics. But he didn't, he's surprised here, Billy, because he didn't expect to see Steven up and about. In his mind, Steven's dead, completely and utterly deceased. But, you know, when he opens this door to the sanctum and he's confronted with Steven, he's, he says, "This is the end for," referring to Clea, and then Steven immediately hijacks his dialogue and says, "You, Dagger, this is the end of, for you." And then he tries to, you know, pull the same trick on Steven. He hurls the dagger at Steven, but Doc dodges the dagger, right? And then he whips out the Eye of Agamotto, and then there's this massive magical battle. It's a whole page of these fantastical magical effects as Clea and the Doc throw up the shield of the Seraphim, and the eye becomes a giant orb attacking them. And it looks almost like they're on a chessboard, but it's just the floor of the sanctum. And then, you know, the Doc just exerts his mental control over the eye because he's got greater knowledge, greater familiarity with the eye. And he's also got greater mental acumen, right, Billy? So he seizes control of the eye and turns it back on Silver Dagger. And this is what you mentioned earlier. If only every, you know, fanatic could be, you know, sort of converted to the truth so easily, right, Billy? And what is the truth? The truth is that, you know, he's been living a deluded life where he's had these fantasies and illusions of, you know, what he thought was reality, and he was just, you know, his own desires was driving him, his own desire to murder, his own desire to elevate himself in the eyes of this fictional lord of his, which he's been serving. So, you know, it's a great ending, and it's a fitting end to someone as reprehensible as Silver Dagger. But, you know, he will return in Marvel Comics, which I do not like, even though he had some wacky storylines in the future, you know, when he returned again as a villain a couple of times. He escaped the eye briefly. I didn't like that. I wanted this to be the end of him. You know what I mean, Billy?
Yeah.
But he, in fact, did become a recurring villain. This was a fitting end, you know, him realizing he was wrong, you know, and then entering the eye, and then this is his punishment, you know, being trapped in the realm of unreality with the caterpillar. And, you know, the fact that he came back as a villain in future storylines, that sort of negates all of the hard work that Brunner and Engelhardt have done on his character in this story. What wouldn't you think, Billy? I mean, he deconverted himself from his fanatical religion, and then again, you know, became a convert later on. Not written by Engelhardt and Brunner, of course, but he was utilized as a villain because subsequent writers and Marvel editorial saw him as too good of a property to waste, right, Billy?
Yeah, I mean, if they would have written a story later on where the Doc had to win the eye and he was in there, then okay, fine, whatever, but to have him come out and, you know, cause shenanigans, kind of, like I said, it does take a little bit away from the story.
Yeah, man, from what I remember reading, I can't quite remember specifically how he got out of the eye, but it was through, you know, with some help, you know, and then he eventually had this, he escaped the eye completely, and he, at first he influenced people. Right, Billy, he used his, I don't know, psychic powers or something. Not that he had any in this issue, but, you know, it was revealed that he could mentally, you know, almost like astrally influence people. He used that to try to kill Stephen Strange again, and then eventually he escaped the eye completely, and then he tried to also take on Werewolf by Night. You know, I remember there was a storyline where he fought the Werewolf by Night, and, you know, he had a gang of like-minded religious fanatics called, I think, the Sword of the Lord or something like that. Yeah. And, you know, that's the name of their team. And they tried to take on Stephen and the other magical practitioners, you know, Shaman. They tried to assassinate Shaman and a couple of the other, you know, magical greats of the Marvel U. So, but, you know, he was eventually obviously defeated. And, yeah, I don't think he died, but he went back into the eye again. So,
yeah, I remember one of the stories was, I think it was Doctor Strange and Ms. Marvel in, like, and or maybe in the two of them and Spider-Man in, like, Marvel team up. But that's the only other time I know I for sure have read him.
Yeah. You're right. You're right. Marvel team up issue. I think I have that somewhere. I haven't read that in ages. So I should look at it again. But
yeah, it's just okay. It's nothing to get excited about.
Yeah. No, it's like he's a great villain. It's true. He's a great villain, mm-hmm. as created, you know, by Engelhardt and Brunner. They conceived of him. I like the fact that he, you know, it's Doctor Strange basically versus religion, right? That's what it is. Mm-hmm. An established, you know, religious organization. In the past, of course, with the CZNX saga, it was Doctor Strange versus creation, the creation myth. But here it's more like, you know, how humans, you know, religious humans react to someone like Doctor Strange being in the world. So
yeah, I mean, it's just it seems like everybody is more focused on trying to tell everybody else how to live their life and how and what to do. It's just like, hey, man. Live and let live. How about we try that?
if we're all just rationally, you know, and empathy, we need to focus on empathy, you know, putting yourself in other people's shoes, and only then can you do what Frank Brunner and Engelhardt did in this issue, which is open our minds a little bit to another possibility, right, Billy?
Yeah, I'd like to think that when they were sitting around smoking some doob and writing this stuff, they were really trying to tell people, listen, just nobody was put on this planet to hurt anyone else. So that's probably what they were thinking.
That boils it down to the essential, Billy. You're right. Look what Silver Dagger was doing in the name of the church. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. He was murdering Doctor Strange, showed him the error of his ways. And so that's a basic storyline, but one that you can apply to many scenarios in the real world and in the comic book realm. So well done there, Doc. And well done to the creative team. Billy, what an issue, man. A fantastic issue. Is there even going to be a Mighty Marvel Missteps? And there's definitely going to be lots of Bronze Age Brilliance. We'll head on to that, you know, in a moment, listeners, after the short break. I can't think of any missteps, though, so I might disappoint you there, listeners. But you know, we'll see what happens. So don't go away. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute.
Is amongst us. Stay back, boy. This calls for divine intervention. I kick ass for the Lord.
All right, we're back with Mighty Marvel Missteps and Bronze Age Brilliance. Billy, I've been, during this brief interim, I've been trying to think of any missteps. I couldn't come up with anything. So I'll let you go first, man. What are some of your, let's start with the Mighty Marvel missteps before we get to the Bronze Age Brilliance so that we can end on a high note. Do you have any missteps?
No, not for me, man. I can't, there's nothing I can pick out of here that I think, you know, was wrong or could have been done better by anybody involved, not even, you know, the letterer or the colorist or whatever, you know, I mean, I just think this four issue story by these two guys was a great way for them to go out, or at least I shouldn't say them, I should say Brunner to go out on, but a big high note. But yeah, they really made you think over this storyline and their whole run. And yeah, no missteps for me, man.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you can't read this issue as a standalone issue. You know, that was going to be my initial criticism, but no, I can't really, no. That's how I read it the first time I did. So that's the reason I didn't like it as much as a kid, but you know, reading it as it was meant to be read in this story sequence, it's almost flawless, you know, the way it was mm-hmm. presented. I mean, even the sexual innuendo that I wanted to criticize, actually, that might not even be there. That might just be in my own sick little perverted mind, you know. There is definitely maybe. That in the you know, the first issue that starts it off, you know, Billy, issue number one, where Clea and Doc are, you know, doing their little picnic in the sanctum, if you know what I mean.
Canoodling.
But here, you know, I don't think that's it. Him becoming one with Clea here, it just, it's a sequence intended to cement their bond, their soul bond that they have between each other. So I'm fine with that. I don't have to keep my mind in the gutter, although I like to do that every so now and then. That's not a misstep. That's just, you know, up for interpretation. And, you know, then I can't fault them, you know, taking on the church. You know, I'm all for that. You know, we should question our doctrine, you know.
I said, it's just, you can question things. And if the people that you're questioning, you know, think they're right, then, you know, they'll have some answers for you. And, you know, just have a dialogue. Like you and I have said before about a lot of things. I don't think Engelhardt and Brunner were, you know, egging people on to go light churches on fire. I think they were just kind of saying like, hey, man, if you, you know, were raised Catholic and you weren't sure about some things, strike up the dialogue and say, I don't think this is right, or I don't understand this. I think that's what they were doing, because they were pretty, you know, peaceful, chill guys. They were trying to just get you to be like, look at things from a different way. And that's cool. I'm glad they did it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree. You know, this is presented as a form of entertainment, you know, so it's pretty entertaining mm-hmm. sometimes to have, you know, because we all know, you know, that something that's on paper does not necessarily reflect something in real life. You know, if you're one of the readers who write in and complain that, oh, is this a comment on real life? You know, you could see it like that, and it's probably what Brunner and Engelhardt intended, but you could also read it as just a form of fiction. You know what mm-hmm. I mean, Billy? There isn't... There isn't not to my knowledge, there isn't an actual... you know, a section of the Catholic Church of witch hunters in present day that deliver people like Silver Dagger to us. No, they don't actively sanction murdering and killing, you know, people worshiping alternative religions. It's just not happening. You know, I mean, there might have been something like that in the past. We definitely know the witch hunters did exist, and I'm saying there might be something we're not, you know, we don't know about that's in the Catholic vaults, you know, a secret organization like that did exist. I wouldn't be surprised, but, you know, I'm not saying it did exist. So, you know, this is could also be interpreted just as fiction, right, Billy? But it's that, you know, it's true that these fanatics do exist in real life, and they do see killing as a means of, you know, cleansing the world and their community of these undesirables. So Stephen definitely being an undesirable in this case. But, you know, there's never been, even though Stephen's a practitioner of the black arts, right, Billy, there's never been a hint or intimation that he serves malevolent entities. You know, he will mm-hmm. sometimes utilize their power, like the Flames of the Faultine, which is actually directly from Dormammu. You know, he will utilize their power, but we know Stephen's a moral character. He only does so in the name of good, and in the mm-hmm. name of truth, and in the name of, in some cases, justice. So Stephen's weird form of justice, which sometimes is the equivalent of banishing an enemy to a plane of unreality for all time. So what, you know, but in Stephen's mind, that is just. So I don't know. But yeah, no missteps for me. Definitely a lot of Bronze Age brilliance. The first one, I'll take the reins here, Billy, for Bronze Age brilliance, mm-hmm. then I'll let you go. Second, mm-hmm. I'm going to say my Bronze Age brilliance is definitely the art, first and foremost, and secondly the plot. But the art and the plot, they're really going hand in hand here. I think because Brunner was co-plotting with Engelhardt, you know, they agreed on certain scenes that they wanted to be in here to showcase Brunner's fantastic art, but also to add to Stephen's, victory, and also to the changes that are now. You know, Stephen and Clea have become closer, you know, not only by bonding their spirits, but also by Stephen rescuing her, and then Clea, in fact, rescuing herself, and then both of them at the end fighting and overcoming the threat, which is Silver Dagger in this case. So it's made Clea a stronger sorceress, because she says, in fact, Billy, that her merging with Steven's spirit has boosted her powers permanently. Did you get that intimation there?
Yeah, oh, for sure.
And so she's become a stronger sorceress and a greater character in her own right, proving that she's very resourceful and also now almost not completely on Steven's level yet. I mean, Steven has now been elevated so far above everyone, every magic-based character in the universe now that he's overcome death. He's now completely the Sorcerer Supreme and the Ancient One all rolled up into one, right? He's immortal now, immune to the effects of age, if not to, you know, the violence. But he's more powerful than ever now. And, you know, then you've also got this bond between Clea and Steven being strengthened. So that's showcased by the art in many cases. You know, that scene where they merge, you know, the astral sex or whatever we called it before. And then also the scene where they flee together. Steven, you know, sort of like a, almost like a Professor Martin Stein and a firestorm effect there, as he follows her around in his astral form when she goes to the sanctum. And then the final battle as they join hands and they, you know, defeat Silver Dagger. It's all, you know, showcased by Brunner's fantastic art. So I can't fault this. This has got action on all levels, right? It's got a hand-to-hand action. It's got mystical, magical battles. And then it's got, you know, these unreal planes that Ditko invented, being drawn brilliantly by Brunner here, right, Billy? So that's all the art for me. And that's what I'm going to give the Bronze Age Brilliance to. And then the plot will be, you know, in second place for me. So what about you? What's your Bronze Age Brilliance here?
For me, it's, you know, it's definitely got to be just this marriage of, you know, Engelhart and Brunner, their teamwork here. I just, their whole run together, and specifically this Silver Dagger story. I mean, I just love, absolutely love, like you said, the artwork's great. I actually enjoyed the artwork as a whole a little bit more when the Doc was, like, you know, in the realm with death and fighting him and stuff like that. I just thought it was a little more, like, I don't know, powerful or dynamic or something like that. I mean, for me, the best two pages in this book that I enjoy are the the first two pages, believe it or not, of the origin of Silver Dagger.
Oh, yeah.
Those are excellently drawn. I mean,
beautiful.
They're just, oh my gosh, yeah. It's like the panel layouts aren't anything, you know, they're very simple, but it's just the shading and the light and the coloring, just everything in those first two pages is excellent. Like, and I love that middle panel where, you know, you see the Silver Dagger sitting there with the candle burning and he's reading in the library for the 6 days and six nights and the Necronomicon sitting there. I love that panel. Oh, it's great.
You know, Brunner's great at drawing these musty old libraries. You know, he's really good at drawing that. And he also captured the Vatican architecture. I mean, obviously this is fantasy architecture. It's not really based on real Vatican architecture, but if you think about Vatican City in your mind, right, Billy, and distort that through a bit of a nightmare lens, this is what he's accomplishing here. Because he's got this, it's got this feeling of you're in these ancient structures and you're entering this old world, this medieval realm, and he draws that beautifully. You know, he did the same, you know, in the Marvel premiere run, the CZNX saga, you know, when Cagliostro was featured and Doc and Baron Mordo went back in time to visit Cagliostro, and he had the same kind of beautiful drawing effect, penciling effect of this ancient library in Cagliostro's office, you know, that Steven... You know, briefly inhabited there for a while. So I love the way Brunner draws these old books. And then we've got the Necronomicon, you know, H.P. Lovecraft's Necronomicon making an appearance there in the library. And that's pretty fantastic, in line with what Steven's been dealing with during the last 20 issues of So, featuring him, Marvel premiere and in his own title. So I love the fact that this is the Brunner saying goodbye, but he's also like still saying, these are all the things that we learned from Steven during this time, the new things that we've added to the mythology, and it all makes a return, you know, mm-hmm. in this final issue. That's also Brunner's farewell. So, you know, mm-hmm. it's great, Billy. I agree with you. It's fantastic. Yeah, the origin of Silver Dagger, one of the craziest origins and also one of the most apt, you know, appropriate origins out there for this kind of character. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, lots of Bronze Age brilliance to choose from.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, we will get some covers from Brunner going forward. I think even into like the late 20s, you'll get a cover here. Oh, yeah. Maybe even early 30s. But yeah, you'll get some really cool covers from him, you know, here and there coming up. So we'll still get a little bit of him. But, you know, interior wise, yeah, this was it for him.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Brunner would go on to have a very successful career in animation. You know, he would design characters for Warner Brothers Animation. He would work on some Marvel characters, X-Men related characters for the X-Men animated universe. Mm-hmm. He would also, you know, do, you know, storyboards and stills for movies. And yeah, so he went on to have a successful career. And even today, you know, he's got, you know, lots of commissions that he does online and also appears at cons every now and then and selling original art. And he makes a good living off of his art, right, Billy? And mm-hmm. still freelance all the way. But, you know, he's been one of the more successful artists. Kind of like a Jim Steranko character, you know. He never really needed comics after he left to keep, you know, his lifestyle going. He went into other art fields and there became a success. So well done, Frank Brunner. And, you know, that's to be expected of someone of his level of talent, right, Billy? It's mm-hmm. just amazing, the art. And, of course, you know, one of the reasons he left this issue was because Doctor Strange became a monthly title, not just bi-monthly, so he couldn't deal with that. Yep. He already warned Marvel beforehand that once it becomes monthly, and it was definitely going to go monthly because of the sales numbers just spiking, right, Billy? It was very mm-hmm. popular at the time. And he warned them that if it goes monthly, he couldn't stay on the book because it's mm-hmm. just, you know, it won't conform to his style of art. You know, he takes his time. And that's why we get these beautiful pieces from him. And, you know, mm-hmm. I'm happy with the way things work out. I would have ideally liked to see more Brunner, but we got Colin back. And, mm-hmm. You know, even with Tom Palmer inking him every now and then. So what more can a guy ask for, right, Billy? After someone like Brunner left, you get Colin on the book. And then later on, we got guys like, you know, Paul Smith. You know, we got Marshall Rogers. We got, you know, a bit of Jim Starlin peppered in every now and then. Michael Golden. You know, so mm-hmm. Doctor Strange didn't suffer from this departure of Frank Brunner at all because there were so many other artists of high caliber that stepped in. So can we really complain, Billy? Can we really complain? That's my point.
Tom, we'll have a few issues of Tom Sutton. Woo.
Oh, yeah, Tom Sutton, of course. How could I have left him out? Damn, those are going to be great. Mm-hmm. One of your faves, Billy.
Trippy, yeah, very trippy.
Yeah, one of mine too, so... Yeah, so good things to come for Doctor Strange. Specifically, our next Doctor Strange episode, right, Billy, we'll have some, we'll go back to some Dark Dimension shenanigans when we see Dormammu returning, but specifically his mm-hmm. sister, Umar. mm-hmm. So we'll have a bit of fun there, too, with Colin coming back in full force with all of his artistic might. So never fear, listeners, mm-hmm. there's still more greatness to come. In the pages of Doctor Strange Volume 2. But Billy, right now that's the end of Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel Missteps. We're going to, you know, keep continuing, just go straight into Shop Talk. And this time around, we've got a bit of an announcement to make. Mm-hmm. Billy, so I'm going to start and let the listeners know. This is a secret project that you and I have been working on for at least 4 months, I would say, from the moment of conception to now that it's come to fruition. So it's already completely and utterly done at this point in time. The listeners can benefit from that if they choose to do so. And specifically, what is the secret project that we've been doing? Billy and I, we've decided to launch a Patreon because everybody's mm-hmm. doing that these days. But that's not the main reason. The main reason is you and I, we like podcasting so much that we've decided to put more shows out there. But, you know, time-wise, that is draining, right, Billy? So in order to as people are fond of saying, keep the lights burning, but also to provide an incentive for us, you and I have launched a Patreon. But, you know, listeners, this will not impact your wallet too much, because if you just want to continue listening to the regular show, which is twice a month, one Doctor Strange episode and then another Marvel Bronze Age weird episode, that's still going to be free. It's going to stay exactly the same. Into the Weird is not going to disappear and suddenly charge you a lot of bucks just to listen to what you've already been listening to and want to continue to listen to. We're still going to stay exactly the same. Everything's going to be free in terms of the regular show. We're going to have, like I say, our Doctor Strange episode and then, of course, any other Marvel Weird episode that we want to talk about. But specifically, the Patreon, Billy, that's going to have, if you decide to join our Patreon, of course, that's going to have three new shows a month, which is always going to be available within the first week of the month, of every month going forward. And Billy, I'm going to let you introduce the first of these new shows, which is going to be exclusive to our Patreon subscribers. What is the first new show that we're going to offer once a month for the listeners?
That would be Dragons and Jive.
Dragons and Jive! Yeah! Mm-hmm. Okay, so why? What is Dragons and Jive? Well, as you know, the Bronze Age, it's all about, you know, Kung Fu and Blaxploitation. And we've married those two concepts in one show, Dragons and Jive. We're going to be talking about one of my favorite characters of all time, Shang-Chi, the Master of Kung Fu. We're starting from the beginning and working our way right through Shang-Chi. But that's not all. Since every new episode that we're going to release every month is going to be an hour and a half or so, right, Billy? There's also going to be room for more. What's the second property we're going to be discussing on this very self-same show called Dragons and Jive?
That would be Iron Fist.
Oh, yeah. In line with the Kung Fu of the time, Danny Rand, the living weapon, Iron Fist, we're going to start from the very beginning with Iron Fist as well. We're going to go through all of his issues, and they're wacky. They're in line with Into the Weird. And then the final property, one of my favorites of the Bronze Age. I've been looking for an excuse to talk about this guy, and now we have it, Billy. And that is Luke Cage, Power Man.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. We got to talk about him. The hero from Harlem, Luke Cage, Power Man. He was a big deal in my life, in my comic book reading life, especially since I came from a country racked with apartheid. I loved Luke Cage. And we got to talk about him. And then eventually, Billy, once we get to the end of... It'll take a longer time for us to get to the end of The Master of Kung Fu. But when we get to the end of Luke Cage and Iron Fist titles, it will coalesce into their Power Man and Iron Fist series, which is one of my favorites of all time. The greatest buddy team ever, in my mind. Power Man and Iron Fist. So that's only our first Patreon episode. You'll have an hour and a half, possibly sometimes 2 hours of that delivered to you on Patreon if you subscribe every month. But then, Billy, there's a second show which will also be available as an hour or an hour and a half show every month. And that second one is one that you and I have decided to call the House of Licensed Ideas. Of course, a big deal of Marvel in the 1970s, you know, a big part of Marvel, I should say, was their licensed properties, right, Billy? And you had a plethora of them. Now, before we get to all of them, I'm going to ask you to introduce the listeners to the first episode, which is available right now on our Patreon, as well as the previous episode I mentioned. It's already available right now, Dragons and Jive, and then the House of Licensed Ideas. And what did we discuss during this very first episode, Billy?
Well, we came right out of the gate with three of the big guns, and one of my favorites. I know it's one of your favorites, and there's always people clamoring for ROM Space Knight. So we're going to be talking about ROM and Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and Micronauts, another one that's, you know, got a lot of a cult following, let's say, to it.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to be talking about them in the first episode, but that's not all, right, Billy? We're going to go through the entire series of ROM, entire series of Micronauts, and the Godzilla, but we're also going to be talking about other licensed properties. Marvel had so many in the 1970s and well into the 80s. Stuff like KISS, they did Alice Cooper, they did Transformers, Battlestar Galactica, Planet of the Apes, Solomon Kane, Indiana Jones. You know, they had a host of TV properties available. Thundercats even made it over to Marvel briefly. Even Masters of the Universe, which was also at DC at one point in time, but Marvel had them. You know, there's so many Marvel licensed properties, and we're going to talk about most of them on this particular show, The House of Licensed Ideas. All right, so that's a fun one, Billy. We had a lot of fun recording that episode. It's available right now on Patreon, along with the Dragons and Jive episode, which chronicles the beginnings of Shang-Chi, Iron Fist, and Power Man. But, Billy, then there's the final episode, which our listeners might be might be familiar with. We've already dealt with something like this before, and it's something that is possibly a bigger part of the Bronze Age than any of the previously mentioned ones. Now, this is also a licensed property, or licensed properties by Marvel, but it's in a universe all of its own, right, Billy? And I'm going to let you introduce this one as well. Since you're the one who originally came up with this idea way back when, on a previous episode. And what is the name of this third and not yet final episode that we have available right now on our Patreon?
This one is Radio Free Hyboria.
That's right. Radio Free Hyboria makes a return, this time permanently, on our Patreon. And of course, Billy, we're going to be talking Robert E. Howard properties out the wazoo. We're going to do Conan from the beginning. We've already done him from the beginning. You, if you listen to the show right now on Patreon, you'll see we've started talking about the first issue of Conan. Conan the Barbarian. And then we've got, of course, your favorite, one of your favorites, Billy. Who is he?
King Kull the Conqueror.
That's right. Now, he's not really in the Hyborian Age, more Radio Free Volusia, but we've included him in this. Why not, right? Since that's how Radio Free Hyboria, you know, rolled the last time we did that on the regular feed. So then we're also going to talk Red Sonja and possibly Solomon Kane, and we might even work in the Marvel magazines at one point in time, Savage Sword of Conan. But right now we're sticking to the colored titles, and the episode that we've already released on our Patreon contains the first issue of Conan the Barbarian and Kull the Conqueror. So that's all available right now, Billy. But listeners, that's not all. Not only do you get these three extra shows every month, you'll also get a potential fourth show, right, Billy? Once we reach a certain level, once we've got, I think our goal is to get 100 patrons. We're hoping to reach that. Then we'll release a fourth episode. And that episode will keep secret for now. But there will be a fourth show available along with the other three we've mentioned every month. Starting in the first week of every month, you'll be able to listen to that on the Patreon once you subscribe. And there are different levels, of course, right, Billy? We encourage you to check out those levels on our Patreon. It's at www.patreon.com/intotheweird. I'll also drop the link in the show notes, and also at sinkintotheweird.com on our blog. There's the main donation level, which just donates to the show, you know, a very small amount if you just want to support us and donate to us. But then when you go a little bit higher, it won't break the bank. Just a little bit higher, you'll be privy to all these. You'll be able to listen to these three new shows and the possible fourth show every month for the foreseeable future. So that's it. That's our Patreon. We hope you listeners, you weirdos out there, will subscribe. And Billy and I will keep delivering content, two regular shows a month, which will always be free, absolutely free. And then we'll have these three extra shows every month that you could listen to on our Patreon. And like I say, eventually a fourth show, which we've already got some ideas for, right, Billy? It's going to be a doozy.
We're really working hard here. We often, you know, sat back and thought when we wanted to do a Patreon, like, you know, well, you know, what would we want from a show that we were going to pay money to, you know, a Patreon? And definitely content is a big deal for us. We want to give you guys a lot of cool content, you know, that we just can't squeeze into the regular show. So what do you do? Well, hey, let's start a Patreon and let's give the listeners some really cool and awesome extra content. So yeah, we're going to be throwing a lot of things at you guys.
Yeah, that's right, Billy. So I'm looking forward to it. Listeners, please help us out, subscribe, and then we promise to do our best and keep you entertained, you Bronze Age comic book fans out there. So, Billy, now I do want to mention something else. Earlier, I spoke about one of our listeners and staunchest supporters, Mitch Halleck, the man who runs Terrificon, which, in fact, has some great guests lined up for later this year. Mitch sent me an email, And the email was all about Gaspar Saladino, and it included a picture of the man, which is quite rare, you know. Gaspar, he's a letterer. I've always liked his name, but I've also loved his lettering. And I've always wondered what he looks like. So Mitch sent me this picture, and I'm going to forward it to you. And this is Gaspar at work in his studio or in the office lettering. And yeah, the guy, yeah, he's a handsome human being. And I wish I had gotten to know him. You know, one of the unsung letterers of the Marvel bullpen. So I want to thank Mitch for sending that picture along and for continuing support into the weird. And you should too. Support Terrificon. And, you know, Mitch himself is a great guy. So, you know, one of our allies of Agamotto came through and gave us something interesting. Of course, I'll post the image Mitch sent us of Gaspar on the blog, right, Billy, at www.sinkintotheweird.com, where you can also expect the addendum post to this episode. And that's where this picture that Mitch sent me will be. Mm-hmm. So, Billy, now it's time for a bit of a break again and then a promo that I'm going to play. And after that, we'll be ready with our recommendations of Ragador. So don't go away, listeners.
Greetings from the Dark Dimension. This is Dormammu speaking, and I'm here to tell you about my Patreon page. That's right, I'm directly competing with Billy D and that backstabbing swine, Herman, who told me that he would help me to launch my own site, but that never happened. Not to force the mindless ones to cobble something together. In hindsight, that might not have been a good idea. Anyhow, soon, Dormammu will have a site to rival that of Into the Weird. Sure, I might freelance for them still here and there at the behest of Ragador, but now, my sole purpose in this world and in all worlds is to defeat them, to beat them, to humiliate them at their own game. Oh, how they will suffer once my Patreon total eclipses theirs. Revenge will be sweet indeed.
All right, we're back with the recommendations of Ragador. Billy, as ever, you're up first. What do you have for us this week?
Okay, so I'm going to recommend a trade. I'm not going to get too into it because I definitely want to talk with you about this eventually down the road. But yeah. I will say it's my favorite Avengers story ever, Avengers Celestial Madonna.
Oh, dude, I love that tale. No, I loved it. Remember we briefly mentioned some parts of it when we did our Forbidden Kisses episode where we chronicled Wanda and the Scar and, you know, Wanda and the Vision's relationship, their rocky relationship. Uh-huh. But yeah, I love the Celestial Madonna, one of the greatest adventure storylines of all time. So, okay. Now, how did you... how are you reading this? Is this a trade paperback? Is this...
Yeah. Yeah, okay. They put a trade out. Let me look at the initial here. 2002, and it contains Avengers 129 to 135 and giant size Avengers 2, 3, and 4. And it's a story about it's all over the place. If I try to sit here and explain it, you'd be like, this sounds insane. And it is insane, but it's a fun insane. So don't get too worried. It's a really good Avengers story, and you've got Kang the Conqueror and all his iterations. And it literally has my absolute favorite interaction of all time with the Avenger Hawkeye, you know, Avenger and Defender Hawkeye. he's in Avengers Mansion, and the swordsman comes in with this person that Hawkeye has never met before called Rama Tut, and Rama Tut lays this story on Hawkeye about what's really going on and how they need to trust him, and he knows how to stop Kang. And Hawkeye's thinking to himself, he's not a bosom buddy, but I don't want to be the one to kick him off the deep end, meaning his partner there, the swordsman, because he's having some issues. So then he looks at Rama Tut and says, okay, Rama Lama Ding Dong, you're on.
Oh, man, that's a classic line. Oh, I remember that well. Oh, Billy, I recently read that in our preparation for our, you know, Forbidden Kisses episode. It's amazing. I didn't know that was the line you were going for, but that's one of the best.
Yeah, I mean, here's what you get. Writers, Steve Englehart and Roy Thomas. Okay, two awesome writers right there. And then pencilers, Sal Buscema, Dave Cockrum, George Tuska, and Don Heck. So, I mean, come on. You gotta check this one out. They probably have reprinted it a bunch of times since then because it's a really popular story. But it's great. You got to get that one. But yeah, there's going to come a day where we're going to go over that trade, you and I.
Oh, we're definitely, dude. We've got to do that on Into the Weird. We could do that on Magazines and Monsters, but I want to ask you politely, let's do it on Into the Weird because it is weird material.
That's crazy.
It's just mad. So we're going to do that. Definitely, listeners, look forward to that. Maybe that'll be a bonus episode where we discuss a trade or a collection or something like that, right? Totally free, listeners. Oh, don't worry, that won't be part of the Patreon. But we got to do that, Billy. What a great storyline. Yeah, I've been getting more, you know, I used to be a huge Avengers fan. I still am. But, you know, I think the whole surge in movies sort of made me almost less of a fan than I used to be comic-wise, you know, because the Avengers on screen are great, the MCU Avengers. I love them, but they're not the Avengers that I read as a kid, you know what I mean? That's why I sort of pulled back. It's sort of the kind of effect of having, you know, a property that you saw as your own and only you were, you know, knowledgeable about it. You were the go-to guy to give information about this property. And now suddenly everybody became an expert because of the movies, you know? So I sort of pulled back and said, okay, I'm going to let the Avengers lie a little bit. But, you know, ever since you and I talked Avengers a couple of episodes back, you know, I've been loving it again. I've been rereading through my old masterworks. Mm-hmm. And the Avengers are, of course, one of the greatest teams of all time. One of my ultimate favorites, you know, along with people like the Defenders, and of course over at DC, you know, the Doom Patrol. So yeah, those teams are just great. I mean, even the Justice League from the 1960s and 70s were crazy, and there were some mad storylines there. So all of them, I have a fond place in my heart for them, but especially for the Avengers. So we got to talk about that, Billy, definitely. All right, so dude, I have something that's related to Doctor Strange this time around, but again, it's not a Marvel comic. I don't know if you've ever read this, but we'll find out while I discuss it. And this is also featuring one of my favorite writers of all time, if not the favorite, Alan Moore. And this is an Image comic, Billy, from the 90s. You might know what it is. Listeners might already know what I'm going to be talking about. And it's Doctor Strange related. And this is particularly 1963. Did you ever read this?
I don't know this one. No, I don't know this one.
Oh, dude, you don't know it. Okay, man, this takes weirdness to a next level, Billy. Let me give you the basic rundown of what 1963 is. It's a 6-issue limited series published at Image Comics in 1993 by Alan Moore, Steve Bissett, John Totleben, and Rick Veitch, the Swamp Thing team, right? This is after they were done with Swamp Thing. Dave Gibbons, Jim Valentino, and Don Simpson also contribute some art to this. And this is a homage to the silver age of Marvel Comics with a little bit of DC in there. But listen to this, Billy, it's crazy, man. This is a parody of Marvel, actually, of the silver age. For instance, issue one features, and it's got amazing art by Rick Veitch and John Totleben and Steve Bissett, but there's all done in the Silver Age style of Marvel, right? In the Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko style, John Romita, you know, senior style. The first issue is called Mystery Incorporated, and that features a pastiche of the Fantastic Four. So you've got Crystal Man, you know, who's Mr. Fantastic. He's this he can shape change into this crystal like forms of you know, it's like he's got a crystal brain with quantum computing capabilities, but he can also shift his body into these crystal prisms and shapes, right? And then you've got Neon Queen, based off of the Invisible Woman. She's got light based powers. Kid Dynamo, who's this electrical, you know, a teenager, obviously based off of the Human Torch. And then you've got
Johnny.
Yeah, you've got the Living Planet, who's the Thing, but his head is in the shape of the rocky surface of Mars or something, or of a planet, and he's got the body of a planet, but he's the thing. Okay, so that's a great issue. It started it off like this. I collected this as it came out, as it hit the stands, or the comic stores, I should say, at that point in time, which I was frequenting in 1993. Issue 2 features The Fury, which is an amalgamation of Daredevil and Spider-Man, and also a lady called Sky Solo, who's a female version of Nick Fury. She's called the Lady of Laser, L-A-L. You know, obviously, this is an acronym. It's LASER, as SHIELD would be SHIELD. You know, this is the Lady of Laser. Yeah. And and then you've got issue 3, which is a Captain America issue. It's called Tales of the Uncanny. It features a guy called USA, and that stands for Ultimate Special Agent. And then you've got Hypernaut, who's an Iron Man, you know, pastiche. Got lots of characters showing up there. And then, you know, issue 4 is the one that I'm particularly going to be discussing now. It's called Tales from Beyond. And Billy, at first it features a Hulk sort of personage. It's a sort of Hulk mixed a little bit with The Thing too, but it's definitely Hulk-based. And he's called the Unbelievable N-Man. And he's this rocky kind of, but he's definitely the Hulk. You'll see why. He's like, got all these, he's based in the desert. You know, and he's got the military, you know, it's definitely the Hulk. And then you've got the one that we're going to be talking about, Johnny Beyond. And he's the beatnik version of Doctor Strange.
Wow.
Drawn in a Steve Ditko style. I'll be posting lots of images on the website and on the blog, listeners, if you want to check this out. If you don't own this series already. And then, you know, just to wrap up issue 5 and 6, issue 5 features Horus, the Lord of Light, which is, you know, obviously meant to be the Mighty Thor. And then the last issue, issue 6, features the Tomorrow Syndicate, which is the Avengers. It has Horus, Lord of Light, Hypernaut, USA, N-Man, and a couple of other people like Inframan and Infragirl, who's supposed to be Henry Pym and Janet Van Dyne. So, you know, the Tomorrow Syndicate make an appearance as the Avengers. But Billy, I'm just going to be recommending this. I mean, you have to read this series as a whole. Each issue is standalone, but it comes complete with letter columns written by Alan Moore to mimic Stan Lee. You know, and then, you know, Billy, you've got stuff like, you know, the Marvel bullpen. Stan Lee called them the 63 Sweatshop. Because after all, in 1963, that's when Marvel hit it big, right? With the Fantastic Four. That's why the whole series is called 1963. So instead of the Marvel bullpen, you have the 63 Sweatshop. You've got Alan Moore referring to himself as Affable Al. And, you know, John Totleman is Jaunty John. And Steve Bissett is Sturdy Steve. You've got Rick as Roarin' Rick Veitch. You know, so he's got... Yeah, he's putting all of this in there, but he's also got criticizing Stan Lee a bit here, because he, during one of the letter columns, he promotes his new book. He says, "Readers, hurry out and buy my new book, How I Created Everything All by Myself and Why I'm Great." Now, that's a bit of an unfair criticism there of Stan, but you know, there was something like that, definitely. There's something to this. But anyway, Moore is firing on all cylinders here. You got the Silver Age down to a pat. He's even simulated the dialogue, Billy, of the Silver Age so well. You know, so let me get to a bit of the dialogue here that I'm going to read to you here from particularly issue 4, Tales from Beyond, featuring Johnny Beyond, Doctor Strange beatnik version. And the story of the issue is called Flipsville. And then Moore starts the issue off by saying, "Watch out, wayfarers, as our wigged out warlock works his worrisome way through the weird and wonderful world of Flipsville." So he's overdoing the alliteration there. And you've got dialogue like this, Billy, since he's a beatnik, listen to this. He says, "Man, pin that crazy threads on that Hollywood eyes. She looks kind of lost. Maybe she needs directions. Wow. Dig that real gone lingo. It ain't hep to word one, except for laundry and that rebop about the Orient." What the hell?
Wow.
Dude Moore's going insane here. It's a crazy comic. And then, you know, Johnny Beyond, he's in 1963, but he meets himself, an older version of himself from 1993, right? And then, you know, so they're beaming through time here, and then instead of the Orb of Agamotto, he's got the Necrosphere, which kind of ties into what happened in the Doctor Strange storyline we discussed now, right, Billy, being the sphere that leads to the realm of death. Mm-hmm. In this case, it leads to the future, because the future is death for him. But Billy, he's even got a Wong, you know, avatar here. And this guy is, listen to this, an Afro-American playing a saxophone. And the guy's called Lips. That's the Wong. Wow. From his Sanctum Sanctorum. Oh, it's crazy. And then there's even a sort of like a critique of the storyline where Doctor Strange lost his identity, you know, and he thought he was someone else, and then he regained his identity. Mm-hmm. Johnny Beyond becomes Johnny Behan, right? And then, you know, at the end, he beats up himself, you know, in the future, his 90... the old guy version of himself in 1993. Yeah. And then he says... You know, good gravy, Davey. Guess I can't blame you for thinking you was all tore up. And then, I mean, it's crazy. Then at the end he says, holy smokes, you ain't fooling, man. You're a whole nother cat. But if you be Behan and you be here, then where be Johnny Beyond? It's like the dialogue is off the chain. Wow. You won't believe it. And it's got lots of good Ditko-esque panels, you know, you gotta pick this up, Billy. It's a satire of Marvel, sure, but it's done so well, you know, and it's great. Just pick it up, man. So Image Comics, a 6-issue miniseries, 1963. Wonderful.
Did they put it out in a trade?
No, they never have. They never did, because there was a rights issue, so the only way you can read it is to get the original issues, which are still easily available, I think, in back issue bins at cons and stuff like that. At least that's what I've heard. You know, I picked it up, of course, when it came out. So my copies are a little bit the worse for wear. But I saw some on eBay, you know, the entire series floating on eBay too, if that's the way you want to go, Billy. But I'm sure you'll be able to pick it up at comic book stores in there, you know, back issue sections. Yeah, man, 1963, Alan Moore and his whole Swamp Thing gang working for Image, doing what they want. There's no holds barred here. Yeah, so read that, listeners. Johnny Beyond in Tales from the Beyond from 1963.
Crazy.
Yeah, man. All right, so next up, I'm going to briefly mention some of our allies of Agamotto. First up, I'd like to mention A Man Called Max. And this is not Mad Max, folks. No, this is Max from Max Reads Comics on Twitter. He's also the co-host of the Weird Warriors podcast that focuses on the weird war tales and other horror properties from DC and beyond. A new podcast that they launched, I think, a month and a half ago or just a month ago. And we played their promo on the last show. And I've since gotten to listen to two of their episodes. And it's a blast. Good time. You got to listen to that and subscribe if you haven't yet, listeners. Now, Max sent me a direct message on Twitter saying, oh my god, guys, I finally got to listen to the episode where you played our Weird Warriors promo, and I am honored and humbled. You had Dormammu himself give us a shout-out. Thanks so much, and I hope we don't let the Dread Lord of the Dark Dimension down. I'm sure you won't, Max. After all, you'll suffer horribly if you do. But no fear of that, because you guys are great. So again, listeners, if I haven't beaten this into your brains enough already, go and download the Weird Warriors podcast. All right, then, next up, we have a 5-star iTunes reviewer who's up for a Bronze Age alter ego, which I'm going to subscribe to him, or, as the case may be, her, right now. I'm not quite sure of the gender of this reviewer. All I know is that this is someone by the name of Organized Sound. And Mr. or Mrs. or Miss Organized Sound gave us a 5-star review, like I mentioned. Very generous, thank you. Now, for new listeners out there, if you deem us worthy of a 5-star review on iTunes, we ascribe a Bronze Age alter ego to you, a superhero moniker, the whole package with an origin, usually a rogues gallery, if I have the time to get to that. So I'm going to first read Organized Sound's review that he or she left for us. And because I didn't have a lot of information about you, Organized Sound, I basically just focused on your iTunes name here to come up with your origin. So I hope that would suffice. All right, Organized Sound said in the review that he or she gave us the following. The more you listen, I finally caught up to present episodes after listening from the beginning. It's really cool to get to know and see the hosts develop their chemistry together. A great listen with great content. And that was left on the 19th of February, 2021. Thank you, Organized Sound. Okay, so I've cobbled together your Bronze Age alter ego, your superhero moniker here, straight from the Marvel Bronze Age. I hope you like it. All right, here we go. And now, Into the Weird presents to you the origin of iTunes reviewer and weird listener, Organized Sound. The man, or perhaps woman, but for argument's sake, let's say a man, who would come to be known in the Daily Bugle as the Audible Actioneer, the Daring Decibel Devastator, or, my personal favorite, the Sound That Walks Like a Man. Our story starts a long time ago in the city of London, where a savage called Kazar defeated a Black Panther and Fantastic Four villain named Claw, the sinister master of sound. Their battle took them from the jolly old city to the heart of the savage land itself, where, at the behest of an extra-dimensional race called the Shinarians, Claw sought to steal the rare metal vibranium to power a portal to the Shinarian dimension. A portal large enough to allow a mighty armada to invade and enslave the entire 616 universe. However, thanks to the brawn of Kazar and the ferocity of Zabu, the Shinarians were repulsed and Claw was defeated. Fleeing the wrath of the Lord of the Hidden Jungle and the slavering jowls of his pet Sabretooth, the man once known as Ulysses Claw traveled with the humiliated Shinarians to their home dimension. There, in a fit of boredom and plagued by more than a little scientific curiosity, he had a wild fling with a comely Shinarian princess. Learning soon after that the princess was now, shall we say, in the family way, due to his amorous attentions, Claw had to escape an enraged Shinarian emperor, and eventually ended up back on Earth. Months passed, and Claw was busily working on his next evil scheme to ultimately defeat and bring the nation of Wakanda to its knees, when a Shinarian portal suddenly opened smack dab in the center of his hidden lair. In a flash of light, the portal abruptly vanished, leaving behind a small metal pod. As Claw cautiously approached, the pod opened, and a wailing sound emerged, a sound eerily similar to a baby's cry. Gobsmacked, Claw stared inside, but saw nothing save a note written in Shinarian, a note establishing the paternity of the strange little dweller in the pod. The wailing sound continued, though Claw could not determine its source. Rushing to his lab, he grabbed various instruments of his own design, sound transducers, sonic actuators, audio absorbitrons, and the like. Using his mastery of sonic science, he quickly determined that whatever the crying thing was, it had no physical form, but was, much like himself, a being of living sound. Having no desire to raise a child, Claw opted for infanticide and murderously scattered Claw Jr.'s essence to the four corners of the globe with a decibel bomb. Unknown to his evil father, the child had the power to reconstitute itself, to organize the sound that made up its living core. It also had the mutant ability to empower its wavelengths with truly unique sounds, and so create solid forms of living sound, unlocking the means to build itself a body. Of course, this being the Marvel Universe and all, unique sounds were a dime a dozen. Rippling in waves across New York and other 616 locales, Claude Jr. started to construct his body. The thwip from a web shooter provided his eyes. The bamf from a cloud of brimstone-tinged smoke, his brain. The katang from cosmic Kree bracelets, his nervous system. The pum-spack from a scourge gun, his internal organs. The snicked from a retractable adamantium claw, his skeleton. And the snap from an ill-fated incident at the Brooklyn Bridge, or was that the George Washington Bridge, provided him his spine. He even ventured as far as Muspelheim, where the doom from an anvil boosted his musculature. Manipulating the vibrational wavelengths of the quantum realm itself, he breached other universes, where a ping enriched his intelligence, a biff-bam-pow his fighting skills, a herm his relentless pursuit of justice, and a bwahaha his sense of humor. His body now complete, Claude Jr. returned to the Marvel 616 universe, absorbing sounds and radio broadcasts from across the globe to give himself an instant education. Aging to adulthood, he fashioned a superhero identity for himself and, after determining his parentage, collared his very first supervillain, his father, Claw. He then ventured through a self-constructed portal to the Shinarian dimension, where he overthrew the evil emperor and liberated the oppressed masses after reconciling with his long-lost mom. Returning to Earth, he embarked on an epic superhero career, facing an increasingly outlandish rogues gallery as he gradually unlocked new abilities via the unique sound effects inimical to the Marvel Universe. This made him one of the most sought-after heroes in the Marvel U, and he is currently fielding offers from the Avengers, the Defenders, the Squadron Supreme, all the X-Teams, and, bizarrely, the Fantastic Four. So let's hear it for the dulcet dominator, the sonorous sensation, the ace of audio, the pulsating, percussive, piercing powerhouse of pitch. Let's give it up for Claude Jr., organized sound, a.k.a. Biosonic, the sound that walks like a man. And that's your Bronze Age alter ego. Thank you, Organized Sound, once again for that fantastic review. I hope you like this alter ego we've cobbled together. Please contact us if you don't, and I'll tweak some things, maybe even rewrite the whole damn thing if you really insist upon it. All right, that was our Allies of Agamotto segment. Now, Billy, I think that's it for this week of Into the Weird, where we heavily plugged our new endeavor, our Patreon, Into the Weird on Patreon. So, listeners, I hope that wasn't too off-putting for you, but, you know, Billy and I, we've decided to make a go of it. We love podcasting so much, and this could only provide us with more incentive to deliver better quality shows. So I hope you support us like that. And you can check out our site over at www.patreon.com/intotheweird. We'd really appreciate that. And Billy, where can they find us online if they want to send some feedback or interact with us in any other way?
Well, definitely look for me on Twitter at BillyD_licious, you know, harassing people and just having a good time out there. I'm always trying to just have a good time and be a part of the fun out here and being good to other people, hopefully. Every once in a while, I get a little cranky, so, you know, please excuse that. But for the most part, I'm a pretty good egg on there. I try to always just be good and nice to everybody. But, yeah, we're always talking about, you know, comics and movies. And then, you know, you talking about your endeavors as well and our other shows and stuff like that. We're really always just trying to be fun and positive and good guys out there. So yeah, we would love your support with our Patreon that we started. You know, that would be great if you would support us. So thank you for doing so.
Yeah, and you know, if you want to email us, you can do so. We're at sinkintotheweird@gmail.com, and you can also check out our website, www.sinkintotheweird.com, where we have this podcast addendum post with images that I've put up there from what we've discussed in the Doctor Strange comic and from our recommendations of Ragador. And you can also follow me at Dark Longbox on Twitter. And then, of course, Billy, you can send us voicemails as well. We've never had a voicemail yet. I really want to play a voicemail on this show. Please do so. Just send an MP3 or something that you record on your phone to sinkintotheweird@gmail.com, and we'll play that on the show. And Billy, let's leave the listeners with a bit of a message. Stay cool, stay weird, stay listening to Into the Weird, and stay supporting Into the Weird. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do so financially, but hey, we would be honored if we learned that you have in fact done so and supported our Patreon. We would appreciate that, greedy buggers that we are. But you'll still be getting the regular Into the Weird. Like I said, we're doing that out of the love of our hearts of comics and of you, our weird listeners. So even if you don't support us on Patreon, we don't mind. You know, it's completely fine. We understand times are tough. And we'll always still be here for you on our regular Into the Weird feed. So, you know, we support you. You support us. Stay bizarre. Stay cool. Stay oddball. And we'll hear from you again, hopefully, and you'll hear from us in a couple of weeks' time, or immediately if you click on the Patreon. So that's it, Billy. Bye from me.
All right, stay weird, everybody.
Cheerio.